It's interesting just hearing some of the talks that were given by various people at the global conference. I'm just seeing some of them again, and one of the little things that I noticed was that there's this little simile or story that Ajahn Brahm gives, and about samatha and vipassana, where samatha and vipassana walk up the mountain, and as they go up there, Mr. Samatha goes up for the, because they want to experience the cool breeze at the top of the mountain, and Mrs. Vipassana goes up there because she wants to see the view from the top of the mountain, and so up they go. And of course the point of that story is that whatever your motivation is, the result is that you get to the top of the mountain anyway. And once you're there, even though Mr. Samatha went up for the cool breeze because to enjoy the nice fresh air, but he also got to see the view. So he got the vipassana as well. And Mrs. Vipassana, even though she went up there to see the view, but she also got to feel the cool breeze and the soft air. So that's a very beautiful simile of the partnership between samatha and vipassana. I'm not quite sure why Ajahn Brahm, when he told that story, he said like Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana, because it always seemed to me that samatha was like the feminine qualities of the mind. It's very kind of gentle, very very caring, very soft, and vipassana is the more masculine side, analytical. I'm not sure whether Ajahn Brahm simply didn't worry about it or whether he was deliberately doing it the other way around. Sometimes people do that. Anyway, so it was that kind of story which Ajahn Brahm used, and it's a very beautiful story. It's one of the things, you know, like in Ajahn Brahm's teachings, he often puts things in a way that's very simple, almost like baby-like, but actually quite beautiful. And of course there's no shortage of cases or examples that we might want to talk about from the suttas, when the Buddha also talked about how samatha and vipassana are very complementary. So I found it interesting in that series of talks, and after Ajahn Brahm gave his talk, then Chigwan got up and gave her talk, and she said, well, as well as Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana, who went up there to stand and watch the view and feel the cool breeze, there was a third person who went up there and just stood. And that was the Zen practitioner. They didn't see the breeze, see the view or feel the breeze. They just went up there and just stood on top of the mountain. And then Ifa got up and said, well, yeah, from a humanistic Buddhism point of view, they went up there, all three of them trooped up. One of them went up to see the view. One of them went up to see the breeze. One of them went up to just stand. But after doing all of these things, they all came down and helped serve in the city and working to help people. So everyone, it was quite interesting, everyone managed to take that simile and use it to tell their own story. Which was very beautiful, because it was a way of, you know, those three monastics, each of them in their own way, quite extraordinary people. And people who are, you know, not into just kind of arguing about those things on a theoretical level, but people who have lived those values very deeply for many, many years, and who really know about what they're talking about. And they're able to take that expression, take that idea, and then use that in a way that's quite distinctive, quite, you know, each had their very clear, different perspective on it. And each perspective, obviously, you know, we can all hear those things, and obviously each of us can hear a truth in those things. We can hear in each of those stories that there is a truth. We might prefer one truth to the other, but we can recognize that each one has some truth or some validity there. And even though each was quite distinct, but, you know, there's no sense that they were necessarily contradicting each other. So in Ajahn Brahm's story, he didn't talk about, you know, Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana coming off the mountain and then working in the city. That wasn't his point. But he didn't say that they didn't. He never said that they stayed on the top of the mountain for the rest of their life. And in fact, you see from Ajahn Brahm's life that he doesn't just stay on the mountain top all the time. He does, in fact, go and serve and help and so on. So I'm interested in this idea, because it reflects something very important or very profound about something about like the partiality of truth. That every time we think that we have a handle on the truth, of course, we're only seeing a part of it. And of course that part, how we see the truth, depends very much on our own perspective, how we look at it. That's going to determine what we see. And so once we start to look at things in this way, then we start to realize that there's no like one authoritative or final story. There's no final version of the truth. And as those of you who know who have had the patience to listen through many of my ramblings and mumblings on Dhamma for a long time would know that this is one of the great follies that I believe that some aspects of the Buddhist tradition has fallen into, particularly the Abhidhamma tradition, where they think that they can get the Dhamma and lock it up so that you have like one absolute or ultimate truth. And I think that this idea of an ultimate truth that we can get a one-to-one relationship between reality and our description of reality, I think this is a very dangerous kind of idea. And so we always have this idea, it's like our truth. When we see things, we see it in our own way, our own perspective. And of course, even that perspective is changing all the time. And how much, in our own perspectives, our own minds, how much are we filling in unconsciously? How much are we adding to what we're getting? And one of the, and again, this has been in my mind because of, as you know, I've been reflecting on this whole, the question of the Bhikkhuni ordination and the story of Mahapajapati and her very, to me, very sad and quite troublesome request to become ordained. And the Buddha's response, he says, Ma te ruchi, do not wish, want, prefer, do not have the idea or the view, or we could translate that in many ways. It's not necessarily clear exactly what we want to say. This is what the Buddha said, don't ruchi, don't wish or prefer for ordination for women. This is supposedly what the Buddha said. And of course when we look at that, there's a tremendous gap, or for me anyway, between what is presented there in the text and actually what we want to know. You know, we want to know, why did the Buddha say that? Well, actually the text doesn't tell us why the Buddha said that. It says nothing. It just says the Buddha said these words. And so, of course, when we read about this, we might read articles, as I've read endless articles, and people discussing these things and having everyone saying their opinion, or he said it because of this reason or because of that reason and so on and so forth. But of course none of those, they're all evidence of this felt gap between what is actually there and what we want to be there. They're not actually evidence for what the Buddha thought. We don't even know if the Buddha said that. All we have is some texts which tell us that the Buddha said that, and they're texts which we know were finalized in the form we have it now, 100 or 200 years after the Buddha's lifetime. So perhaps the Buddha said that, perhaps he said something similar, perhaps he said something in a different context that was taken out of context, etc., etc. But somehow there's this, from this state of unknowing, there's this wanting to know. It's like this gap, this tension. We feel this tension between what we know and what we feel we need to know. And into that gap, this is where we project our dreams and our hopes and our aspirations and our beliefs and our desires and so on. And it's very important to have a sort of a sense of healthy respect for this gap. It's not like a problem. If there wasn't any gap, then it's impossible that there shouldn't be, but if there wasn't, then no one would be motivated to do anything. You'd be like complacent. And so in a sense we're all here tonight. Everyone's come here because they feel that. And somehow in our hearts we feel like a yearning. How do we describe that? What does that mean to us? Like how do we experience that? Everyone will experience that very differently. But nevertheless, there is that thing which is similar, that thing which has pulled all of the people here to come to this very unusual place. And so we've got this pull which has brought us here. And that pull is that gap, that difference between where we want to be, what we want to know, what do we want? Of course, what we want, peace, don't we? We want happiness. We want wisdom. We want freedom. We want freedom. And we're not free. One of the sayings I always remember my father used to quote to me was a saying by the French Enlightenment philosopher Rousseau, who said, "Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains." And of course, this is a statement like on a social level in society. When we're born as babies, in a sense, we're free. We can do what we want. And as we grow up, we get more and more tied up in the weights and expectations and laws and customs of our society. It's a very beautiful saying, one which has already always struck me, but I think on a Buddhist perspective, like when Rousseau said that, like it's almost like an expression of the wonder of that. It's almost a paradox. Like, how can it be that we're born free and yet somehow we end up in chains? How is that possible? So it's an expression of the paradox of that. And in Buddhism, the paradox is almost that, well, the wonder is like the other way around. We're born in chains. So from a Buddhist point of view, we are born because we had ignorance, we had craving in our past life, and that made our consciousness take birth in this life. So we're in chains when we're born. And yet somehow there's this yearning to be free. How is that possible? How is that possible that we... Why? Why is it that we feel this need to somehow be free? If all we've ever known is enslavement, all we've ever known is imprisonment, why is it? What are we yearning for? What are we looking for? We're looking for something actually we've never known. We've never known Nibbana. We've never known complete freedom and liberation and cessation of suffering. We have these words about these things, and those words create an idea in our mind, create a concept, and that concept creates this yearning. And we know it's something we want. And so this is what motivates us. This is what pushes us into practice. This is why we go to such extreme lengths to build big meditation caves. This is why we give up our families, shave off our hair and come and ordain as monks and nuns. This is why we leave everything behind and come to a monastery and come to the forest. And somehow there's a feeling that there's a prison and that there's this yearning to be free. Why is that? Why are we born in chains and yet we have this longing to be free? And so into that space where we feel that sense of incompletion, the sense of lack, the sense of wanting, into that space we project our ideas about who we are, about where we're going, and about how we're going to get there. And of course, all of these ideas are ludicrous. They're not merely inaccurate, they're unutterably, hilariously laughable. That people like us can sit around and we think we understand ourselves. And in fact, we know on one level, we know that our minds are obscured and darkened by ignorance and delusion. And on the same time, that delusion is so clever. Never think that delusion is stupid. Delusion is the most intelligent thing in the world. And delusion is always one step ahead. So delusion is telling us that we know who we are. And it's telling us, because we're Buddhists, this is the interesting part, we know that this is the voice of Mara. We know that we're deluded. And yet we believe it anyway. And this is how subtle delusion is. As we were talking earlier about Mara in Buddhism, like Mara, it's not like the devil, this kind of implacable kind of embodiment of total evil. It's this kind of idea, it doesn't have any part in Buddhism. but Mara is more like the trickster. And of course, Mara is the one who's always telling you, do good, make merit, give offerings, go to heaven. Mara is the one who tries to get into an alliance with God. And so in this way, Mara reflects that those workings of delusion within our minds. Mara always comes in a disguise. He doesn't come as Mara. Anyway, what does Mara look like anyway? You know, if he's without his disguise, what does he look like? Well, Mara always comes in disguise. He's the master of disguises. He's always wearing a mask. And it could be anyone. And who's underneath that thing? Mara. Moggallana said that he used to be Mara in his past life. It's very weird, isn't it? The Buddha's second most disciple, but in his past life he used to be Mara. Shows how flexible these ideas of Buddhist cosmology and so on are. You can be Mara and then later on you get reborn as the Buddha's second left-hand disciple. He was born in hell for his deeds as Mara. He had the body of a man and the head of a fish. And so the workings of Mara in that particular sutta are very interesting also. And so in that time he was the Mara Dusi. And he really wanted to trick the Buddha. It was in the time of a past Buddha. I can't remember which Buddha it was. And so he was always kind of playing tricks on the Buddha and so on. And then one time when the monks would going in for alms round, and he possessed all the minds of all the villagers in the town. And when they saw the monks, and then they would just yell obscenities at them and tell them to get lost and pick up rocks and throw them at the monks and things like that. And it seems like this was a kind of experience which monks actually had to go through in India, even though in the Buddhist scriptures don't talk about it all that much, but in the Jain sutras it seems to talk about it quite a lot. Maybe because the Jains never had a bath for their whole life, might have had something to do with it, I'm not sure. But in any case, so that's what happened, and you get rocks and things thrown at you. And so when they came back and they were bleeding and their bowls were broken and so on, and the Buddha said, bear it, he said, just develop loving kindness. Go back, meditate, develop loving kindness and you'll be right. And so Mara was like, drat, foiled again. So okay, next time the monks came in for alms round, and this time Mara says, okay, this time I've got him a much sneakier trick. So he said, okay, get everybody dressed up in the nicest clothes and prepare all these beautiful offerings for the monks and give them the most delicious possible foods. Oh, so lovely. All those delicious Indian sweets, you know, the ones made out of kind of boiled milk and sugar and things and all of those kinds of very, very lovely things. And they gave all of these luxury things to the monks, and they came back and the monks said, okay, monks, develop a suva. You have to do cemetery contemplations. You have to contemplate the elements. And Mara was foiled again. So these are the ways that Mara works. You know, sometimes he might be violent and aggressive, but just as often, he'll come in a very attractive package. And it's very interesting. One of the most powerful of Ajahn Mahabua's talks, when he talks about this so-called original mind that he talks about, and there's one particular very famous talk where he's talking about this, you know, unbelievable, unparalleled radiance and purity of the citta and the radiant mind and so on. And then he says, you know, it reached a certain stage in his practice where he realized that the radiant mind is ignorance, and he described it as the most beautiful Miss Universe in the whole world. This is the radiant mind. It's almost like this is what Dajahn Brahm calls the last bastion of the self, is this kind of sense of the consciousness, the purified consciousness, which you can experience in meditation. If you develop very deep samadhi, you experience this kind of very purified consciousness, and it's so amazing. It just opens it up, spreads itself up before you in this field of golden light. And it's like, what is this? What could this possibly be? Something that's completely indescribable. And so this, the more subtle our mind gets, the more refined our meditation becomes, then the more clever Mara gets. Because Mara, or delusion, whichever you want to think about it as, is delusion is also part of the mind. When you make your mind refined, you're making your delusion refined, because the delusion is part of that. The better your mind works, the clearer your mind, the clearer the delusion is, the more subtle it is. And the strength of that, the power of that, is revealed in the very fact that as your mind becomes clearer, you think you're closer to the truth. The more you think you're closer to the truth, then the more that subtle kind of mara is creeping in, that subtle kind of delusion, which is going to end up taking you away from the truth. Coarse mind has coarse delusion, and the refined mind has refined delusion. And so, you know, we have this situation that we're in. We're at a certain place, and we have an idea, a deluded idea in our mind about what that place is. We have a deluded idea in our mind about who I am. What am I like? What kind of person am I? What kind of character do I have? What do I want? What do I need? And then we have a deluded idea about the goal of practice. We have a deluded idea about what nirvana is. Maybe more or less close to the truth. Maybe a, you know, more or less deluded, but there's still some delusion in there. And then we have a deluded idea about how to get from where we're at to nirvana. And so all these delusions, by the way, multiply, they don't add up, okay? So you take one and you multiply it with the next one, and then you multiply it with the one after that, and so on and so forth. And so they keep getting bigger and bigger. And so our conception of the path, of course, is deluded as well. And we can always take a teaching and take it in the wrong way. And as was, of course, beautifully expressed by Shakespeare, the devil can quote scripture to his purpose. And certainly, if you're quoting from the Bible, that's absolutely true. If you're quoting from the suttas, like I said, it's equally true, but it takes a little bit more refinement. And if you want to quote the suttas to an evil purpose, you can, but you need a more subtle mara. Yeah? And if you want, you can find a few isolated passages that seem to have a negative attitude towards women, like the story I mentioned before about Mahapajapati. And if you want to take that out of context, if you want to ignore the fact that, you know, the whole of the life of the sasana, the Buddha seemed to regard the fourfold assembly as the natural, normal part of a complete and fulfilled sasana. If you want to ignore that and all of the very positive things said about bhikkhunis and so on in the suttas, then you can quote just one or two passages and come up with a very negative perspective. So always remember that mara can quote the suttas to his purpose. And so we can always take these particular teachings that we think are very beautiful, and like the teaching I started off this evening with, the teaching of samatha and vipassana, like the harmony of samatha and vipassana. And this is something which, as you all know, that is something I think is very important to stress in our modern times. I think you know, the way that Buddhist meditation has been presented in the early phase of its introduction to the West was badly mistaken in pitting samatha and vipassana at odds with each other. And I think that's a slightly sick misrepresentation of the Buddha's teachings, and it's kind of passing away. That had its time, it had its generation, and now that's coming to an end. And so it's very important to be presenting this kind of the harmony, the complementariness of these things. And there's a very beautiful teaching when we look at meditation. You know, when you're practicing meditation, your mind becomes peaceful. There's the coolness in the mind, the expansiveness of the mind, the bliss of the mind. This is the samatha, and then there's the clear seeing, the knowing of things as they are, and this is vipassana. So we emphasize how these things help each other, not how they fight each other. So this is like a perspective on Dhamma, but it's a perspective which is very conditioned by a particular experience. In my case, the conditioning is very clear and very obvious. When I first started to practice meditation, I went to a Vipassana center, and they were teaching a very extreme version of the Vipassana teachings, and basically warned us off samatha and told us don't get attached to the bliss, and said the Buddha never taught us to teach jhanas and blah blah blah, and all of these kinds of things. And this is like, in retrospect, it's a bit crazy that they should be teaching those kinds of things, but there you have it. I still have tremendous respect and gratitude to those people because they really introduced me to the Dhamma, and I benefited a lot. But I had to outgrow those teachings, and I had to explain to myself why I had to outgrow them. And in doing so, I saw that there were many other people who'd had similar experiences, and so I had to try and explain for them because of their doubts and so on. So that's why I ended up writing these long, complicated books about this sort of topic. But that's just like a perspective. That's just like a way of looking at things. And so I developed my own ways and emphases and so on looking at the Dhamma. But you'll have your own things as well. So I don't want you to think that you know, just because you come to this monastery that you're all going to end up with the same vision of Dhamma as I do. That you're going to emphasize the same things, that you're going to think the same things are important or whatever. Everyone will have their own different take on it, their own different perspective. And there are some things which are some ways in which we can rely on the guidance that we get from the suttas, from the teachings of the Buddha, and that they do give us some framework. We have a faith that there is, you know, a voice, a teaching which is not coming from delusions, not coming from Mara. And we have a faith that those teachings are embodied in the suttas and the Vinaya. And so there's that, like that leap of faith between what we know and what we want to know. Of course, we don't know that the Buddha actually said anything. We don't know that the Buddha even existed, really. It's just an inference. We can say, well, there's certain evidence for it, and it's likely for such and such reasons, but we don't know. And so we have this faith, which we can regard as a reasoned faith. We put it into practice, but always doing it with that sense of lightness. And I think this is perhaps one of the most important things that we have to learn, is to have that sense of lightness and a slight playfulness about how we approach the teaching. Yes, of course it's serious, but how can we make it too serious if we really know that we don't know? How can we insist that it must be one way and not the other, if actually in the back of our minds we know, actually I don't really know. And so, in a sense, we have to always try and keep like a kind of a what if about what we're doing. And so we miss that kind of like quite naive or youthful faith which a lot of religious activity relies on. You know, and I'm thinking of, say, evangelical churches and things like that, where people, you don't really think about much, you don't really have much of a doctrine or anything like that beyond a few fairly banal points of dogma. And then you get together and sing songs and have fellowship, and you raise up a kind of feeling of faith and rouse up a feeling and maybe speak in tongues or have some raptures and all of these kinds of things. Well, in Buddhism we don't have that, or at least in this kind of Buddhism that we're teaching here, we don't have that kind of very overt or very simple, overwhelming, like an immersion in those kinds of, that kind of level of religious experience. And it's like an immersion, you're just kind of throwing yourself into that and you know, in a very quick time you can experience these things, you can experience the trance states, you can experience the speaking in tongues and these kinds of things. And they can take you over, but they're not very transformative, they're not very subtle. So the approach that we're taking here is more nuanced and more, it's harder to see what exactly it is. It's a bit more balanced. We don't want to go for those completely overwhelming emotional states. We might experience them in our meditation, that's not uncommon. We'll you know, experience an overwhelming rapture, our bodies will be filled with joy and the hairs will stand up all over the body waves of electricity shooting through us and so on. And these things happen, and this kind of level is, I think, similar to that kind of level that's happening in terms of those evangelical experiences that I mentioned before. But of course this is not samadhi, this is just like something you get over on your way to real samadhi. And the real samadhi is actually very cool. And a really refined sense of joy and metta and so on, it's very cool. It's not this overwhelming sense of emotional outburst. And so this is what we work with when we have that motivation to practice. It's not necessarily something which is so obvious, but it's something which is there every day. This is what makes us keep on going every day. It makes us meditate, it makes us study, it makes us try to overcome our defilements in various situations we find ourselves. Keep going every day, little bit by little bit. This is how this works. And so as we're practicing, we keep on trying to work with this gap that we're experiencing, the actual facts that we've got, and then what do we make of it? How do we interpret it? We're guessing, how are we going to do it? How are we going to respond in that situation? Other people around us are also guessing those things, and they're responding in their own ways. Everyone's responding in their own way to their own circumstance. Just as the story I said at the beginning, we had that one story. And then three people, all of whom have their own wisdom and their own experience, can all reflect on a given situation, each in their own way. Quite different ways, and yet quite complementary, not necessarily contradictory. So this is all I wanted to say for this evening. I offer this up to you for your reflection. And I hope that's been of some use for you. Does anybody have any comments or questions? The right kind of faith. Well, the right kind of faith is the faith that destroys itself. If you're really confident in it, you don't need it anymore. If someone offers you a cup of coffee and says, oh, I've put two sugars in there, you haven't tasted it, and so you have faith that there's sugar in the coffee. Yeah? Once you've had a sip, then you don't need your faith anymore, do you? Yeah? You know for yourself whether there's sugar in there or not. Yeah? So that's the perfect kind of faith. It's the faith that destroys itself. Yeah. So you need to try. That's the purpose of like yoniso manasikara, that working or attending to the cause of things in the right method. Yeah. So you go from where you are to where you need to go to actually see those things for yourself. And once you've seen them for yourself, that's it. You don't need it. So that's that faith. The right kind of faith is the faith which calls us or demands that we test it. Yeah? It demands that we don't take it for granted. It demands that we have to go out and keep on to testing it, not just once and be happy with it, but to keep on testing it again and again and again. It's the right kind of faith. Until it's destroyed. He's coming to the conclusion. Yeah. Yeah. But it's very good ones, isn't it? Yeah. That was Sariputra or something, wasn't it? He said he didn't have faith. Asadho. You've got me there. That's just that's slightly different, I guess. It's like the respecting or worshipping something slightly different from having faith in it. Faith is more like the motivation. But I guess there's, it's one of those things where, like what you're saying, it obviously is true that that's one of the qualities which Buddhas and so on have, is they have that quality of faith. But I guess it's a matter of getting tripped up by the words. Is that? Yeah, it's obviously a mental quality which they have, but it doesn't mean the same thing as faith means for us. Like the word changes, which, and again, so I'm just playing with words when I say you destroy the faith. Like in that example when you have the drink the coffee, it's not that. It's not that you lack confidence in the fact that it's either sweet or not sweet. Yeah, it's the fact that you know it.
There's a reference to two types of faith, the blind and reasoned faith.
That's right, yeah.
I think it's important to make those distinctions very clear when we're talking about notions of strength and faith.
So how do you know if your faith is blind faith?
Blind faith.
Yeah, because people who have blind faith don't think that it's blind faith.
For example, a belief in God cannot be tested. Like the
presence
of God can't be tested.
Can be reasoned.
Yeah, it's like drawing a very long bow.
Maybe. It's a long bow, I agree with you, but I'm just playing Mara's advocate here. But the belief in God, there's very many very intelligent people, much more intelligent than you and I, who have believed that it's possible to, base the belief in God on reason, starting with Plato and the whole tradition, up to, modern times. For example, all the founding fathers of America, all those guys, they were very intelligent. That's basically what they believed. And many other examples. So we might say, I'm just asking, I'm not trying to establish that you can prove God's existence. I'm saying, how do you actually see within yourself whether what you're saying is blind faith or reasoned faith?
I think it's whether or not it's universally testable. It goes a long way to determining whether or not it's reasoned or blind faith. If thousands of other people can agree with you on this particular thing, it's less likely to be blind.
So it's democratic, is it?
It's
all
democracy.
This didn't never actually make that distinction as such. I think maybe because it's not really a talking about distinction, because to some extent all faith is about it's the nature of faith.
I mean, they sort of do talk about Akaravati Sadha.
Yeah, but they never make the dichotomy of that. Maybe it's relative.
Yeah. See? Yeah.
With Tom, who happens to have seen some sort of phenomenal thing, It's about testing it for yourself and seeing, can I see that particular thing
in
my own ego?
Yeah. But I guess the point that I was just trying to make there is like what I was talking about in the talk, that just that, you know, I guess as long as we're not enlightened, we just have to be a bit light about that, you know, because we can't ever really know, and we think of course our faith is reasoned, but they, you know, so do the suicide bombers, you know, think their faith is reasoned as well, you know, and so it's good to be a bit humble about that. I mean, Buddhists do. I do think Buddhists, including myself, we do tend to be a bit arrogant about these things. And you know, Buddhism does obviously is a very rational religion. But you know, it's not so. I mean, if you look carefully at other religions, it's not so obvious that they're not rational in the same sense. That rational, saying something rational is different from saying something's true. And but I think maybe we're a bit conditioned by Catholicism, which is almost like aggressively irrational in some ways. Whereas a lot of religious faith is not particularly irrational. Anyway, that's a bit beside the point. Okay, maybe we should call it a night.